Kathy Hodge, and I'm a professor of mycology at Cornell University, which is a kind of a pinch yourself kind of thing. Like, how did I end up there? That wasn't really what I was planning, but here I am, and I've been a professor at Cornell since 1999, and people think I know stuff, which is weird, because I spent all my life trying to learn the new stuff, like, what's the explanation for all the stuff in the world that I see? What's it doing out there? How does it relate to me? And I still feel like, although I have learned many things, I'm here for the things that I don't know. That's what really is exciting about life, learning like the new interesting stuff. Not like new in the world, but learning anew how the world works, how things outside of me fit together into this beautiful world. So I thought I would start by talking a little bit about my origins. And I have this picture of a beautiful lake near Georgian Bay. Georgian Bay is the kind of ear of Lake Huron, one of the Great Lakes. And when I was a kid, I grew up in Canada, and I spent most of my summers in this part of the world because both my parents were teachers, and we had the summer to explore the natural world. And so, whereas many of my colleagues in academia wouldn't call themselves naturalists anymore, which is a sad thing to me, I am a naturalist. Mm-hmm. Because of my childhoods running around in this beautiful ecosystem. That word up at the top there, Cordyceps militaris, is the name of a fungus that has come up several times today and might even come up again in the next talk. It's a fungus that was the first fungus I really met as a kid. It looks like this. And I probably met this fungus when I was 7 or 8 in the woods, where my parents would just let me run around for at least half a day until I got hungry, and no worries about sexual predators or, well, bears were a bigger worry. But I had a good life. I wandered around in the woods and found stuff like this very fungus here, Cordyceps militaris. Do you know it? Have you seen it? Yeah, some of you. It looks like a little skinny orange finger that sticks up out of that thing at the bottom, which for many years when I was a child I thought was a bullet. It was kind of a romantic notion that a spent bullet lying in the woods might be colonized by a really interesting fungus. And I had back then an early mushroom field guide by Orson Miller in which I found this fungus, and I learned that bullet is not a bullet, but it's a caterpillar. It's a caterpillar that's become a pupa and is going to emerge into a moth, except this fungus did a really good job of killing it. And I think because of this fungus, I became really interested in the strange realm of parasitic things, things that grow on other things. And I was lucky to spend part of my, I still am spending part of my academic life actually studying these fungi in more detail, and I'll tell you more about some of them later. So maybe this fungus is why I became a mycologist, I'm not sure, but it's a good gig. But I realized recently that all throughout my entire childhood as well, my mother was busy hooking these like weird mushrooms, you know, things that are on the wall. She sold them at craft sales, they're made out of wool and hooked with a rug and sculpted with a pair of nail scissors. I never really thought about whether maybe this is the reason I became a mycologist. But let's not go there. Recently, just very coincidentally, in the last 6 months, Cornell University, where I work, acquired a copy of John Cage's mushroom book. And what an amazing thing it is. So I'm really excited to be here talking to you on this John Cage Mycology Weekend, and back home is waiting for me this wonderful thing which we are hoping to plan an event around at Cornell. I can't say that I'm a cage expert, but I'm really curious, and I've learned a lot this weekend, and I have so much more to learn, but I'm just so excited to be here. In this mushroom book, of course, are very many beautiful illustrations by Lois Long. And as David mentioned, also the obscure academic writings of Alexander Smith, written in the most technical jargon you could possibly imagine. And I love, in my life, I love the intersection between art and science and parasitism and cooperation. And my research program at Cornell now focuses mainly on molds and other things that people really don't like very much, except me. So at Cornell, I do research on fungi, on insect pathogenic fungi, on molds. I also run one of America's larger herbaria, a museum of fungi. We have about 400,000 dried collections of fungi, and you saw some of them in David's presentation. Here's one that I think David didn't show, which is one of John Cage's own collections of fungi, housed now at the New York Botanical Garden. So anyway, at Cornell, I run a similar large collection of fungi. And because I run this big museum, it makes me have to expand my vision beyond weird parasitic things to the full biodiversity of the full kingdom of fungi. And it's like the most wonderful place that I know to be. But also because I'm a biodiversity expert, I end up teaching courses on fungal biodiversity. And here are some of my students and my teaching assistants. We think fungi are pretty awesome at Cornell. We have a long reputation for working on them back into the 1860s. And we have a very joyous spirit. I told my students to pose, and this is what I got. This is the typical pose of the mycologist. But really, I think the typical pose of the mycologist is just this kind of exuberant joy and wonder in the world, right? So you've seen this picture a few times. That's John Cage looking happy. And he's saying, nothing more than mushroom identification develops the powers of observation. And I want to talk to you a little bit about observation today. So my talk, cryptically titled Seeing Fungi, could be about anything at all. But based on my my teaching and my interactions with people around fungi, I want to share some stories and some maybe insights. I have a kind of large internet footprint, and so people find me from all over the world, and they send me their pictures of fungi, and they ask me their questions, almost all of which is, what is this? Or, sadly, how can I kill this? And I spend a lot of time with these questions. I get at least one every single day of the year, a cold call from the internet from someone I don't even know. And I like to answer those questions when I can. Do you know these two fungi? On the left here, a beautiful orange mushroom. On the right, a deadly green one.
Do you get a prize if you answer it right?
Sure.
Is it Amphilobus aludens and Amanita phalloides?
Do you guys agree? What do you think? Are you just agreeing with her because of the confidence with which she's Yes, you're exactly right. And you do get a prize. Right, so the beautiful orange mushroom, Omphalotus aludens. Why is this man so happy to find it? Later he was happy because he learned it glowed in the dark, but at the moment I took this picture and then told him this was a poisonous mushroom, he became very disappointed to know that it was not a chanterelle. This mushroom, this big orange mushroom, Omphalotus eludens, is in fact the most common poisoning call that I get. I get this call from people at night who are throwing up. Their husbands have to call me because they can't speak. They're throwing up somewhere. They have diarrhea. They're in the hospital. Their physicians want to know what they should do. Wait it out. The mushroom on the right-hand side, it comes from a colony in Rochester, New York. It's an introduced mushroom called the death cap, Amanita phalloides. Perhaps this mushroom has killed more people in the world than any other mushroom. It doesn't occur in my area, but this mushroom that I'm holding in my hand, this mushroom comes from a colony that's killed at least four different people in Rochester. And yet, it's hard to eradicate. So what is it? Can I eat that? Yeah. When I think about these questions, there's a joke in mycology, right? You can eat any mushroom once. It's not very funny. Anyway, all these questions make me think about how do we know what things are? Like, why is that the most common question that I get? So this year with my field mycology class, where we actually go out in the woods every Wednesday, we pick mushrooms, we bring them back, and then after dinner, we all come back to the lab and try to figure out what they are. It's the most fun class to teach, and also the hardest in a way, because it's not an easy thing to do, identifying mushrooms. Have you tried it? It's really hard. Right, and really, really satisfying when you do actually get a name for something. This year in my class, I gave pairs of students mushrooms. It was the first meeting of the class, and most of them knew nothing about mushroom identification. And I asked one student to describe the mushroom to the other, and I asked the second student to draw based on what they heard, right? So one student received this mushroom, a beautiful white coral fungus. And his partner drew this from his description alone, which I think is really beautiful. And I asked them a little bit about the process, which apparently was very frustrating to the person who had to listen, because how do you describe a coral mushroom if you've never seen one before? And so one of the characteristics that led to this drawing, which looks like scribbles on a stem, was this mushroom has tiny hands. So what you see here is scribbles on a stem with tiny hands. A coral fungus. So they even evade description, right? It takes a while to get to a point where you can actually describe a mushroom to someone else and they can fully picture it in their head. And this point has never come across more clearly than in all the poisoning cases that I end up dealing with. This from last week. This is a coral fungus, and what I'm showing here is a slide of little fragments broken off the tips of a beautiful white coral fungus. This coral fungus put someone in the hospital for 2 days. Even though what I repeatedly hear from people is that coral fungi are really, they're all fine. They're just eat whatever. You don't even have to identify it. But that was not really true in this case. There are a few poison coral fungi out there. But in many mushroom poisoning cases, I'm on the phone with someone. They call me up. They're sick, or they're worried they're about to be sick, or their friend is sick. And I say, well, can you describe the mushroom? And if they haven't taken a cell phone picture of it, then we have an interesting and circuitous conversation. Well, what's it look like? Well, it's a brown, round, and smells like mushroom. What is it? But you know, you can't laugh on the phone because somebody's really suffering there in the background. It's a serious problem. Well, can you describe it a little more fully? And the interesting thing about describing mushrooms or asking someone to describe a mushroom is that you can't lead them. You can't lead them. If you say, well, does it have gills or pores? Then they're gonna pick one of those even if it has teeth. Right? You know what I mean? So you have to very patiently try to draw them out, and sometimes it's just impossible. Sometimes I end up with a specimen of a mushroom to identify. This one, I reconstructed it from the pieces of mushroom that fell out of the mouth of the pig that was eating it. The pig was sick and had been eating mushrooms all morning. What do you think? Brown, round, smells like a mushroom. Made the pig sick. It's a honey mushroom, Armillaria mellia, which I was able to confirm with some microscopy and some close looking. Armillaria mellia, the honey mushroom, the humongous fungus, is a popular edible, right? But if you don't cook it, you can get pretty sick from it. And pigs are pretty bad cooks. I got a phone call from a couple who had bought some honey mushrooms at a farm stand in the Catskills somewhere, and who had eaten them while they were driving because they were hungry. They also got very sick. I got this mushroom in the mail. In the background is my predecessor, George Francis Atkinson, the first, like, full-on Cornell mycologist. He died in 1918, and he described this fungus. And this is not a whole mushroom. So these are terrible challenges to identify, right? When you get a piece of something and somebody's really sick in the hospital, in this case, what is that mushroom? Do you want to guess?
Stinkhorn egg.
It looks like a stinkhorn egg, yeah. So it's a white thing, it's like a little ball, it's broken off on one side. I'm holding it in my fingers and it's about 5 centimeters around, or in diameter. When I opened the package that came by FedEx, the smell hit me so strongly. Not a stinkhorn smell, but a faint smell of bleach. The bottom of an amanita, the bottom of a destroying angel. Those mushrooms have pretty distinctive smells. Death caps, which I showed you earlier, the green ones, they have like a smell of like decaying flowers, like overpotent grapes and flowers. But Amanita bisporigera, which was described by Atkinson here, smells faintly of bleach. Smell one next time. Smell one. That's this fungus right here, this very beautiful and very poisonous mushroom. One time I stepped outside my building and a volunteer from the hospital came with a paper bag and showed me the same mushroom inside the bag, this very one, which had been eaten, two of them had been eaten by a patient the day before for dinner. He went out square dancing after dinner with friends, and he bragged about the delicious white mushrooms that he's eaten. And one of his square dancing partners said to him, "My grandmother told me to never eat a white mushroom." And then planted the seed of doubt in his mind so that later, when he went home, he looked through his mushroom guide to see what it might have been. Couldn't be this destroying angel, he thought. Couldn't be. But sure enough, at midnight, he woke up. And this mushroom, diabolically, tastes okay, apparently. But tastes fine, but at midnight, maybe 6 hours, 8 hours after your meal, it wakes you up with really bad cramps and throwing up and diarrhea, and you know you're in trouble. Or maybe you don't, and maybe you just think it's food poisoning and you don't do anything about it. But he, because of his friend's warning, he took himself to the hospital, bringing with him the bottom of the bulb and stopping on the way to pick up the other specimen that he had left in the woods. And sure enough, it was this fungus. Now, he survived. Richard Eshelman is his name, and you can read his story on the Cornell Mushroom blog, which I wrote for many years. He survived mainly through supportive care and good luck, and because he didn't eat the third one. He mistook it for this mushroom. This is the shaggy mane mushroom. It's a big, tall, handsome mushroom with kind of scaly cap. It's white. It comes up in composty fields and yards, and it slowly degrades itself into black ink. It has black spores. You can write with the ink of the spores. So here's my question to you, like, how could you mistake this deadly all-white mushroom for this black inky cap thing, very different in their natures, right? One edible, one deadly. I asked Richard this question and he said, well, the mushrooms that I ate had kind of bell-shaped caps. And so I remembered in my old mushroom guide that I couldn't find at the time that those bell-shaped caps were always shaggy manes. So he had keyed in just on the one character that wasn't going to help him identify these mushrooms, right? Right. Other people make different mistakes. So it can be a problem of, I didn't know which part of it was important to look at, right? How would I know what that was? Is it because it's white, because it's bell-shaped, or because it has a white spore print? In this poisoning case, and I promise I won't only talk about poisoning cases, but here in this one, I talked on the phone with the man who ate these mushrooms. He didn't die. He's all right. He actually had a really interesting time. These are a mushroom, an Amanita species called multisquamosa, Amanita multisquamosa. It's a beautiful kind of beige-looking mushroom with big warts on the cap. It has a nice vulva at the bottom if you dig it up. We tell beginners never to start with Amanitas because some of them are the most deadly mushrooms in the world, right? But some Amanitas are some of the more fun mushrooms in the world because they're hallucinogenic or entheogenic or psychotropic, depending on your perspective. My Amanita multisquamosa fruits kind of rarely, except that summer, last summer, it fruited everywhere in upstate New York, this thing. And I had two different poisoning cases with it. And when I talked on the phone with the man who ate these mushrooms, he had taken a very special precaution. He had picked a whole bunch of them. Why? Why did he pick them? I said, do you normally eat mushrooms? I don't normally eat mushrooms, but there were so many of them and they looked so delicious. He said, I took a piece of one and I fried it and I ate just a morsel on a fork and then I waited an hour. And nothing happened. So then I thought, well, I'll try a whole cap, and he fried up a whole cap and he ate part of it and he waited an hour and still nothing happened. So then he fried the whole batch and they were so delicious that he just ate them all like a frying pan full of big delicious mushrooms. And he was quite pleased with himself. And then he found he had some trouble moving around the house. When he went to flush the toilet, he said, my hand wouldn't go to the place where the flush was. That's called ataxia. And he said that he that night had the most delicious and delightful deep sleep he had had all his life.
Wow.
And when he woke up the next morning, he was still stoned. And he talked to me on the phone for a long time. Well, I tried to figure out what his mushroom was. And it was this. It was this. But it's always interesting to me how people come to the decisions that they make. They send me pictures like this. What are these mushrooms? I don't know. They're white discs. Maybe they're styrofoam. Maybe they're frisbees. Sometimes you just need more information to identify something. But sometimes even the least little bit of information can lead you, bam, directly to an identification. So in this slide, these spores, I fished them out of a piece of mushroom that got taken out of a dog's stomach, a dog who was very sick. And these mushrooms are not just sort of oval. They have little bumps all over them, very diagnostic little bumps of the genus Inosopy. Inosopy doesn't kill people, hardly ever, but it does kill dogs pretty frequently. Inosopy is a little brown mushroom normally, and it has a bump on the cap called an umbo. Super cute, little small for people to bother with, but they often smell really weird. They have a smell that's described in the books as spermatic or earthy sometimes, and dogs apparently are drawn to them. So I've seen probably more than half a dozen dog deaths due to Inosopy species. So when I teach my mushrooms course, my students and I focus early on looking at the parts of a mushroom that will help you know it. How do you know what it is? What do you have to look at? Is it just the color? Is it the shape? Well, it turns out it's all kinds of different things, right? And just to observe those things, you have to become aware that they exist. And then you probably need some way to describe them. Do the gills attach to the stem? Do they travel down the stem in a decurrent way? You need to know some terminology, which can be really off-putting for beginners. But it prevents people from making mistakes, right? If you're able to describe a mushroom pretty fully, then you probably know it better. Right, here's Here's a box full of mushrooms. Somebody sent me this picture 2 days ago. Is that chaga?
No.
Bunch of black stuff. Yeah, they're, what are they? Does anyone know what they are?
Fomiteres.
Yeah, I'd say they're fomes. Yeah. They're fomes fomiteres, the horse's hoof fungus. It's not chaga. This one is chaga. It's also like black chunks chipped off a tree, but different black chunks. You probably need some way to describe your black chunks.
Just a recommendation.
So here's a piece from John Cage. I'll let you read it. Oh no, I guess I better read it since I'm on the air. Once when Lois Long was on a mushroom walk led by Guy Nearing, a mushroom was found that was quite rare. Guy Nearing told Lois Long that it was Pleurotus masticatus. They then walked along, and Lois Long, realizing she had already forgotten the name of the mushroom, said to Guy Nearing, "I just can't get the name of that mushroom into my head. In fact, I have a terrible time remembering any of these Latin names." Guy Nearing said, "When you don't know the name of a mushroom, you should say it first to the person in front of you, and then to the person in back of you. Soon you'll find you'll remember it." Which I like. Because names are important, right? Names are important because communication. Here's a beautiful image of the enoki mushroom, the velvet shank mushroom from John Cage's mushroom book. Done by Lois Long. And on the left is an illustration of the same mushroom as you might buy it in a supermarket. On the right, that's a full, rich, colored mushroom with honey colors on the cap and bright white gills and a velvety brown stem. That's as you'd find it right now. And in fact, I think Mary found one just the other day that we left in the house on the counter. Okay. But if you buy this mushroom in its cultivated form, it's grown in a kind of a collar to make it grow up toward the light. Because of course mushrooms can see light. They grow upward, longingly toward the light. And this looks more like the mushroom you might find in your Japanese soup, enoki mushrooms. Here's a mushroom that some of you know. These are white, blobby mushrooms that some people call hunter's hearts, or what else do we call them? Shrimp of the woods. When I was young, we called these aborted entoloma, which is a terrible name. But they're just these white, blobby things, kind of hard to describe and convey what they look like. We eat them. They're pretty tasty, scrambled up with some eggs, but what are they? It turns out they get their name, Entoloma abortivum, from the parasite that's consuming them. So in this picture, you see a little gray mushroom on the left. That is the culprit. That thing is eating another mushroom and basically imprisoning the young mushroom of its host in white mycelium. It's a very tasty white mycelium, but still seems kind of evil. And the mushroom that's being imprisoned there is at the core of that white blob is a button of the honey mushroom, Armillaria. I showed you some pieces of Armillaria drooled out by a pig earlier. And I told you also it was the humongous fungus, the largest fungus in the world. And here it is eating a stump in the Adirondacks. The honey mushroom. And there's a picture of it by Lois Long. So some mushrooms you think you know, but you find them in some other form. And it's hard to even perceive they could be the same organism. I'm a taxonomist of fungi. I've described lots of new species of fungi and a handful of new genera of fungi. I'll show you one in a bit. But one of the more interesting questions to me about mushrooms is not only being able to describe what you see, But being able to find them in the first place, right? Like you go out there in the woods of good faith. Maybe you think you're going to find a hen of the woods, and of course you don't. But sometimes you find the most surprising other things, things you may have never seen before in your life. And this is what my students do with a giant puffball that's full of holes. When they have a lot of extra mushrooms that they found, they just planted their extra mushrooms in the holes in the giant puffball, creating this kind of monstrosity that was later eaten. So there's an actual field of study out there about like how do people find stuff. Foraging, let's call it foraging. When you're out looking for something, how do you do it? Do you just, one of my mentors would just lay down on the ground and stare at a particular spot within arm's reach for like an hour. He specialized in really small mushrooms, a tiny cup fungi, and he would find a kajillion things that nobody else could even see. But if you're looking for mushrooms to eat, here's one study that found that although men and women in the study found the same numbers of mushrooms, men covered way more distance, spent way more energy, whereas women kind of went more methodically and more efficiently to find the same number of mushrooms. I can't really speak to that because who knows how many mushrooms I find. There's supposedly a region of the brain called the locus coeruleus that helps you find novel things. It helps you perceive them. Like there's so many things in our lives, if you think about it, that are all around us all the time, and with that we just don't even notice at all until one day we're like, what, that radiator cap is really weird, or there's a new kind of mushroom I've never seen before. And ironically, I think, magical mushrooms in the genus Psilocybe seem to activate that part of the brain. Mm-hmm. So that things that you've seen a million times seem new. And you see things in a new light. And I think I could easily spend many days talking about the subject of what magical mushrooms do and how they might alter your perception of reality. But I'm not going to talk about that today. I'm going to skip right along. I'm going to talk a little bit about how my students do it. So I take my students out on every Wednesday in the field and I set them loose. Find fungi, I say. And here's what a student finds maybe 4 weeks into my course. But the first day is really interesting because some students find everything orange. And some students find everything big. And some students find nothing. Some find shelf fungi. And then that night we come back to the room, 24 of us in the room, all with our different collections, and we go around and we look at what everybody else found. And then bam, the next week, everybody finds diverse collections to work on. Something happened, right? They got to see like what are the ways things could be, like what kinds of things might I find? And then they find them. John Cage actually spoke about this too when he talked about a friend of his teaching him a mushroom that I just showed you there, the enoki mushroom. For the first time, somebody showed him the enoki mushroom at night with a flashlight in the woods. And he had never seen it before in his life, but every year after that, he found it. Having seen it once, he's primed somehow to find it, right? And I know one person in the audience here at least can find tooth fungi that most of us never find, right? But you develop an eye for things, a speciality. For me, I find cordyceps and molds and tiny things. And other people find only boletes. My mentor, Dick Korf, who I talked about lying in the grass recently, found this fungus. We found this fungus in 1994 when I was a student. We went out and this fungus was everywhere in the woods that year. And Dick had worked his entire life on this group of fungi and he knew of the existence of this fungus, but he had never found it before. That year in 1994, we found it in almost every place we went to collect. Just a kind of subtle thing. It's a white fluffy mold on some sticks and some mosses. It's really beautiful under the microscope. But he had never seen it before. It had never been found in North America before. And in all the years since then, we didn't find it again until 2017. And then in that year, it was everywhere too. It's a fungus called Glycheroderma, and up close, the spores are like perfect globes worn on tiny pins on fungal hyphae in this crusty fruiting body. A beautiful thing. So for some fungi, maybe you just have to see them once, and then you find them everywhere. But for other fungi, it's the fungus itself. Maybe this thing only fruits every, 20 years or something like that. I don't know. It's kind of a mystery. My students are great mushroom enthusiasts. They're frustrated. It's a long learning curve to learn how to identify things, isn't it? John Cage said, "Often I go into the woods thinking, after all these years, I ought finally to be bored with fungi. But coming on just any mushroom in good condition, I lose my mind all over again." And I bet that a lot of you have the same experience as I do. And even the things you find while you're looking for fungi just blow your mind, and they're just incredibly amazing. And here's my students, what are they doing? They're digging up a cordyceps, a beautiful parasitic fungus that only sticks up above the ground about 2 inches. But if you know what it is and you dig down with your knives, you will find the false truffle host underground. Spheres, fruiting bodies, full of spores, really interesting fungi. My students think I'm crazy. On an exam last year, one of my students drew me strumming my banjo, singing to my shiitake log. And then on a later exam, angry because she hadn't studied. But I like this view of myself as a cartoon character. I feel it sometimes. We're delighted by fungi. I don't know how to explain what it is that's so delightful about fungi. But here's a beautiful little orange elf cap, right? And it seems like the deeper you go, the more delightful they are. So if you take the time to put the spores of this fungus under a microscope, they're perfect cubes. They're like perfect little grains of salt, except alive. How can that be? Here's a fungus that fruits every year in the lawn outside my office. Every year it comes up through the grass and decapitates itself. It severs itself on the grass. It chops itself to bits as it comes up. And we have never been able to identify it. It's a red russula, clearly, right? Any fungus that's that fragile, like, come on, it's gotta be a russula. Have you ever thrown a russula against a tree? It's very satisfying. It seems rude, but they do shatter delightfully into little bits. This fall, though, there was this day of perfect fog and mist and rain, and the grass was slippery, and this fungus came right up through the grass, almost intact, without chopping off its own head. It's a beautiful red russula. Turns out that in North America, there's over 200 species of red russulas. So we still don't know what it is, but at least we know it in its fullest form. It makes a dark, almost yellow spore print, this one. So when you're a taxonomist, one of the things you have to do is you have to perceive things that nobody's ever perceived before, right? It's a bit of a trick. So here's an Earth star, which you heard about earlier from David, a beautiful dune-inhabiting Earth star from Cape Cod. Turns out that many of our Earth stars still don't have species names, but they're not the only ones. Among the fungi that I specialize on, lots of them still need to be named. And I have a kind of personal feeling that that in order to really perceive something, you need to have a name for it. This is my personal bias. I think if you can't talk to somebody about the thing you found, then it's really hard for it to sort of materialize in people's minds. So what's this? Some stripey thing on a log. Does anybody know what that is? It's a millipede, yeah. If you pick up this millipede and handle it a little bit, it thinks you're trying to kill it, so it makes a terrible smell. It smells like cherries, actually. If you smell it, the smell of cherries is really the smell of cyanide that it's releasing to try to kill you. But luckily, although one of these millipedes can kill six mice, it can't kill me. I started finding these millipedes dead in the woods right near my house. Just dead, just like that. I didn't know what was going on. Sometimes they climb up somewhere high and they're just dead with their heads dangling down there. This is Aphaloria, this millipede, a common aposematically colored millipede in the Northeast. And I have studied fungi that kill bugs for pretty much my whole adult life, and it took me years to perceive that this millipede is being killed by a fungus. And if you look at that picture, you can barely see that between the segments of the millipede are bulging, glassy, white mycelium coming out there. 2 years ago, we named this fungus for the first time not only a new species, but a new genus of fungi. Was it new in North America? No, it wasn't. I went to Harvard University, where they have a very old herbarium, and I looked through that herbarium and I found this fungus from over a century ago in the Northeast. So it's not a new fungus, it's just newly perceived and now newly named. If you look at this dead millipede up close, you'll see that between the segments, it's like stretched out like an accordion, and white mycelium has been actually shooting off spores that look almost like the sprinkles of salt that you see in this picture. We named that fungus Arthrophaga, which means it eats arthropods. And we gave it the name Myriopodina to honor Thaxter, the Harvard mycologist who had first observed this fungus and meant to name it over 100 years ago. He never got around to naming it, but we used his name. I love these fungi. They're weird, small, insignificant, not really insignificant. They change whole populations of millipedes, but they're also pretty common. What's this? It's a bug. What is it? It's a cicada, yeah. Is there anything weird about this big cicada with red eyes? Missing its butt. Yeah. It takes a doctor. Missing its butt. If you look right up its butt, you find, that's what you have to do. You find that it's full of fungal spores. This cicada is a relative of that millipede killing fungus. The cicada killing fungus has been known for a while, but I'm a co-author on a paper this year that found that this fungus makes psilocybin. Psilocybin, the thing that makes magical mushrooms magical. The compound that affects your brain and activates your locus coeruleus. We often wonder why fungi make the chemicals that they make. Why do they do the things they do? And in this case, we think maybe that psilocybin alters the cicada's mind so that its behavior's different. And the behavior change we see in these cicadas is that when they get infected by the fungus, not only does their butt fall off, but they try to mate with everything in sight. All the other cicadas, male, female, doesn't matter. And mating, when your butt has fallen off and you're full of spores, remember this in case it ever is relevant to you, can spread the spores to another cicada. Right? I feel like I'm just like on a tear now. Anyway, turns out if you look closely at things, there's always more to know. So I should finish up soon, but I want to just give you one more example of like seeing the unseen. Ding. And it involves foam. Man, this is a good good time of year to look at foam. And when I say foam, what I mean is the foam that accumulates in streams or below waterfalls. You know, billowing big patches of foam. Sometimes they're yellow and gross looking, and you always think, oh, somebody put soap in there, or that's pollution. But it's not always. And that foam's been around for centuries. Some of it's biologically generated sort of detergents made by decaying leaves. But that foam is actually really well stabilized by a particular kind of fungal spore. And nobody had ever seen those fungi ever before until this guy, Ingold, C.T. Ingold, one of the premier naturalist mycologists that I can think of since Reginald Buller. Ingold went out into his backyard in the UK and he looked at foam and he found within it very many fungal spores. And they look like this. Yeah, that's Tetracladium marchalianum. And the spores of this fungus look like jacks. They have long legs, four of them sticking out every which way. And this one has little dangly bits that are a little cheeky. But it turns out that there's lots of fungi in foam, and they all share this four-legged shape. They're like little stars in foam. Their four legs actually help to stabilize the bubbles in foam, which is partly why that foam under the waterfall stays there so long. They're stabilized by tiny fungal spores. These are the spores of fungi that their job is to eat the leaves that fall into the stream. They eat leaves on the bottom of the stream, and they make these spores that tumble along the bottom of the stream. And the major challenge they face is when they find a new leaf, how do they hang on when the stream is blowing them downstream? Well, that's why they have that shape. It's a very stable shape. If you can land with three legs down and you can germinate very quickly like these spores will, you can grow right into your leaf before you get washed off. It means that if you want to pick up some foam to look at these spores, you got to get that foam to your microscope really quick or those spores all stick to the inside of your jar. But they're beautiful, beautiful things, and they're incredibly diverse. And yet, until Ingold found them in, I'm gonna say like the 50s, if I hope I'm right, nobody had ever observed this entire group of fungi before. They turn out to be essential to stream ecosystems because the little bugs that live in streams eat them, and the trout that live in streams eat the bugs, and this fungus, this group of fungi are key to those ecosystems. So you're welcome. Now you know. All right, I think I'm just about at the end of my time here, so I'm gonna just skip to the very end of my talk. Don't worry, we didn't miss much. I'm gonna just show you a picture of this little fungus because I wanna end up with molds, which are very my favorite things. I feel that boletes are just excessively large and a little bit vulgar. And a hen of the woods, although I would be happy to eat one, is just, well, that's just overkill, isn't it? What I really like are things on the scale of millimeters tall, just a few millimeters tall. And so here's a very beautiful little fungus that grows on wood. It's mycorrhizal. This is a mycorrhizal fungus that you'll find in forests called Chromylosporium. And what you're looking at here are different phases of it. The purple puffs, which we'll zoom in on a second, are about to make their spores. Their spores are kind of beige, so the beige puffs are covered in spores. Here's a close-up of the beautiful structure of these fungi. It looks like little bristly toothbrushes or something made of purple crystal. Just incredibly gorgeous. And then once it starts to make spores, they form all around those branches as little globes. They look a lot like Glycyrrhoderma, which I showed you earlier. But this is the kind of thing, like, I feel like the kingdom fungi has just these layers of wonder in it, right? Like, you could start by looking at boletes or hens of the woods, and you could end up in a place like this, really very different and very beautiful. Or you could go big if you want. an ATM, a bank machine in Greenfield, Massachusetts, which has a giant bracket fungus hovering over it, presumably shedding spores on me.
Can you eat it?
Yeah, you could eat that. Pretty sure it's medicinal. Oh, so I don't know. So I don't know where we came. Where did we get to with this talk? I hope I conveyed just some of the fascination with the kingdom of fungi, and just how they challenge our ability to perceive and describe the world around us. I think it's a really good exercise. And I was thinking about John Cage, and how fungi are just so apt in a way, because some of that voyage of perception, right, is explored by John Cage in his own different way than me, but fungi kind of force us to look at the spaces between things, to pay attention to the sounds that we don't hear, right? To think about how the intersections of things create something new sometimes. And I guess lastly, just to think about the wonder that we have, the joy we take in the beauty that's all around us on so many different scales. So thanks for listening.